हरिः सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्तिः 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 ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवत्सलिकौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
The BBT purport mentions, previously the Shiva Jwara felt himself to be unlimitedly powerful, and thus attempted to burn Sri Krishna. But now he himself has been burned, and understanding that Sri Krishna is the Supreme Lord, he humbly approaches to bow down and offer praise to the Absolute Truth. According to the Acharyas, the word Sarvatmanam indicates that Lord Krishna is the Supersoul, the giver of consciousness to all living beings. Krishna confirms this in the Bhagavad Gita 15:15. Matas mrityar jnanam apohanam cha. From me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. The words kevalam gyapti matram indicate that Lord Krishna possesses pure omniscience. According to our limited understanding, we act in this world. The Lord Krishna, with his unlimited understanding, performs infinite works of creation, maintenance, and annihilation. As Srila Jiva Goswami points out, even the functions of the gross elements, such as air, depend on him. The Taittiriya Upanishad 2.8.1 confirms this, right? Because the function of the gross elements, such as air, depend upon him because he is the ingredient cause. So why things work is because it's him. That's the only reason. The Taittiriya Upanishad 2.8.1 confirms this. Bishasmad vata pavate. Out of fear of him, the wind blows. Eko deva sarva bhuteshu gudaha. The one Lord resides deep within all beings. Svetashuptara Upanishad. Thus, Lord Sri Krishna is the ultimate object of worship for all living beings. So that's what the Shiva Jwara then is pointing out. You're the absolute truth to whom the Vedas indirectly refer. The Shiva Jwara continued, time, fate, karma, the jiva, and his propensities. The subtle material elements, the material body, the life air, false ego, the various senses, and the totality of these as reflected in the living being's subtle body. All this constitutes your material illusory energy, Maya. An endless cycle like that of seed and plant. I take shelter of you, the negation of this Maya. The BBT purport mentions. The word bija roha pravaha is explained as follows. The conditioned soul accepts the material body with which he attempts to enjoy the material world. That body is the seed, bija, of future material existence. Because when a person acts with that body, he creates further reactions, karma. Right? So, which grow, roha, into the obligation to accept another material body. In other words, material life is a chain of action and reaction. So, this whole thing of the bija is the seed of how everything works. So because of the body, that's the seed. Because of our attachment to the body, identification with the body, we perform things with the body. So it's the seed of our performing action, and the results of that action then produce our further body. Does that make sense? Just like our desire for a material activity is the seed. And so by that desire, then we act upon that, then the seed sprouts. Right? So now we've done the action, the seed sprouts, so then that will then in the future give the result. Does that make sense? So that desire for material activities is the seed, and that's manifest through the body. So as soon as we give up the attachment to the body, we give up the attachment to the enjoying the material world, right? Or better, the other way, is that we give up the desire to enjoy the material world. There is no more material seeds of karma. And that means the body is no longer seen as a seed for that process to work. Does that make sense? That's why it always mentions about how the devotees of the great sages, they've gone beyond, they have no material interest. It's not just they don't have any attachment, they don't have any interest. So that attachment means I can get a benefit. But when it comes to the point of this particular aspect of material energy, how can that be used in Krishna's service? Then that's what we're talking about. Right? That's the meaning of unattached. It's not a neutral thing. We see it in connection with Krishna. It means in a neutral, that's very difficult. To give up attachment to something without an attachment to something else is difficult. Right? But it's just like a child. They're attached to one thing, and if you just tell them no, it'll be a big fight. But if you give them something else that's better, then they give up that attachment. Does that make sense? So, that's the whole process, is that by seeing everything connected to Krishna, then we give up the material attachment and the desire for it. Therefore, the seed of desire and the body as the seed, that these are ways to enjoy, those are given up. Because his propensity, the jiva's propensities are based on the modes of nature, right? And to engage the senses, the sense objects. So he's just engaging the 24 elements for his own pleasure. So that's why it's done.
Like the polluted consciousness.
Yes, the whole thing. But he's using polluted consciousness also. He enjoys the polluted consciousness. Right? The simple decision to surrender to the Supreme Lord releases the conditioned soul from this futile repetition of material growth and reaction. According to Srila Sridhar Swami, the words tan nishedham prapadye indicate that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, is nished bhavadhi bhutam, the limit of negation. In other words, after all illusion is negated, the absolute truth remains. The process of the limit of negation, right? So you have negation, and at some point there is nothing left. You've negated everything. So Krishna is the limit of negation. Means when you've negated everything, he's what still remains. Yes.
Although Mayavadis use that process, they never come to that conclusion somehow or other.
Because they see the Lord as material, so they've already negated him also. So if you're only negating material things, the Lord can't be negated because he's not material. So then once you negate all the 24 elements, then all that's left is the Supreme Lord. But they're counting him as part of as a mode of goodness. So then he gets negated in their process.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone who's not attached to their body, or not thinking that their body, not attached to their conditioning, they acknowledge what it is, but they're not like ashamed. They can't be ashamed of it, and they can't be proud of it.
Means it is what it is.
Yeah.
You may be ashamed that you are in the material world and you left Krishna, gave up serving Krishna to come here.
Mm.
That you can be ashamed of, but the particular body, it just is what it is. What's the problem?
Yeah. But it's got to go both ways. They can't be proud of the good things.
No,
like
they can't. Yeah, you can't be either, because either way, then it's going to be false ego.
Yeah.
You just use it what it is. Just like,
yeah.
It's not that you're proud of the knife or ashamed of the knife to cut it cuts the potato. It doesn't matter what you're thinking. The process of education may be succinctly described as a way of eradicating ignorance through the attainment of knowledge. Right, so that's what we're doing. We're removing ignorance by the process of knowledge. It's not gaining facts and figures, gaining knowledge, knowing so many things, being able to make the connections between all those. And because of that, we're the best in the world. Does that make sense? That's not the thing. We've written books, we go to conferences, we've gotten awards, we've gotten recognition. That's not the purpose of knowledge. The purpose of knowledge is to remove ignorance. So people say, yes, no, we're less ignorant than we were, but we still are just as ignorant if we don't know who we are, who God is, and what the material nature is. Through inductive, deductive, and intuitive means, we attempt to refute the specious, the illusory, and the imperfect, and elevate ourselves to a platform of full knowledge. Ultimately, when all illusion is negated, that which remains firmly in place is the absolute truth, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ultimately, when all illusion is negated, that which remains firmly in place is the absolute truth, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the previous text, the Shivajwara described the Supreme Lord as Sarvatmanam, Kevalam, Gyapti, Matram, pure, concentrated spiritual consciousness. Right? That's what we mean. You saw that? Sarvatmanam, Kevalam, Gyapti, Matram, pure, concentrated spiritual consciousness.
Got it. I have a question. When all illusion is negated,
yes.
What remains is the absolute truth.
Yes.
But then there is no need to negate the illusion because we don't see in connection to Krishna.
We don't see the illusion in connection to Krishna. But that the illusion is not in connection to Krishna, that has to be negated. Because the point is that illusion is there, it's acting under Krishna's potency. So it's Krishna that's making the illusion work.
Okay. So connecting the illusion to Krishna.
Means we're not in illusion, we're trying to remove illusion, but the point is that there is illusion, that's because it's Krishna's will. It's his potency that does it. The living entity wants to function outside of Krishna. There is no such situation, it's already an illusion. So therefore, then, so that illusion can work, then the whole material creation is there. So that's why the living entity, when he comes to the material world, he's already in ignorance. So we see the Shastra is describing that before the modes, it says that there's ignorance. Then, from there, then the elements are separated and all this, the forms of life and the modes of nature. And then we'll say, no, but if goodness, passion, and ignorance are manifest at this point, then how is there ignorance before? Because that ignorance is the karna sharir, that I don't see the relationship with the Supreme Lord. So that's the original ignorance. Mm-hmm. So even though you get rid of all material, seeming material ignorance, you'll still be in ignorance because even though you know everything, you still don't know what that everything's for. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now the Shivajwara concludes his philosophical description of the Lord by saying in this text that the various aspects of material existence are also potencies of the Supreme Lord. Right? So that's the whole point, is that it's all Krishna, but it's all Krishna as his potency. Srila Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur adds, he begins to elaborate on the Lord's pure consciousness, Kevalam Gyapti Matram. First, the objects excluded by use of the word only, kevalam, are enumerated. Time, kala, is the agitator. Karma, action, is the subtle cause. That which brings about results is daiva. Swabhava is the ability to possess this daiva and karma. Jiva is the holder of this swabhava. Dravya refers to the subtle elements or tanmatras. Kshetra is prakriti or matter. Prana is the sutra, right? It holds the whole thing together. Atma means ahankara, right? So when we say the atma here, then when we're talking on the material, we're technically not meaning the soul. We're talking about the false ego that the soul has, because the soul is not identifying as the soul. the soul is identifying as its false ego. So in this way, then, when we say Atma, we mean the false ego, right? Or whatever aspect, the body, the mind, you know, their intelligence, whatever it is that they're attributing to themselves. Does that make sense?
Sorry, are you reading Vedanta Sutra?
No, we're reading Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on chapter 63, Lord Krishna fights with Panasura.
Okay.
That's what we're saying, is that here, Bhagavatam is the natural commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Mm-hmm. So when you see it in its, when it's discussed in its natural context, you see that dealing with one, you're dealing with the other.
Yeah.
So in one sense, there's no difference in the one. In here, you'll have a story along with it. In Vedanta Sutra, there's no story. It just goes from one technical point to the next, while the Vedanta, while the Bhagavatam will give the technical points, and then there'll be a story in between. And the technical points are someone describing it as part of a story. So the, so of the two forms of the Nyaya, Prasthana, Shruti, then the Shruti is better because of the Puranic aspect of story. So the storyline people will catch more than on the other. That's why then when we're studying the Vedanta Sutra, we're studying in context with the commentary and the Bhagavatam in which it was connected. So that's why then it, you can't really tell the difference. Yeah.
I was thinking this morning also is that Vedanta Sutra, as we finished the first part, it deals with Brahman.
Yes.
But then Bhagavatam deals with Bhagavan, which is much sweeter.
Yes, yes, yes. But all the aspects of Brahman and Paramatma are seen in context of Bhagavan. While like you're saying, the Vedanta Sutra, you're seeing Brahman just in as Brahman, or Paramatma just as Paramatma, or maybe Brahman in context of Paramatma. But it means it will be mentioned it's about Bhagavan, but it's not much. It's just like the example, like when we're going through Manu. Then when we get into the section on sacrifice, it was talking about the offering of animals and sacrifice. So it's the whole run of it, the description's about 30 verses. Now, in the first verse, then it's opening up that anything done as sacrifice is not sinful. So if an animal is being killed in connection with the sacrifice, it's not sin. You won't get a sinful reaction for it. Because you have it, there's no sin involved. You're following scripture, like these kinds of things. So the animal will be elevated. Like that. So they go, instead of being whatever they are, they'll go from that up to human form. So all the lifetimes in between what animal they're in now and human, then is going to be, how do you say?
Eliminated.
Yeah, eliminated. Because you come to human form from monkey, cows, or, you know, lions, tigers, like this. So, and those aren't used in sacrifice, right? And so then, in that case, that means there's going to be some lifetimes in between being a horse or something else, right? Or a porcupine, or, you know, whatever it is. Yeah. So then the benefit, like, so there's no sin. And so it goes into great detail explaining this so that people can't say, no, but you're killing animals, this is wrong. Then, after that, then he explains that, you know, the word, you know, for flesh is mangsa, right? So that being broken down into its parts is mam saha, right? So mam, you know, I say, I kill you, saha, you kill me. So therefore, I'm killing you this life, next life you get to kill me. And so, therefore, someone who's intelligent, why would they get involved? Right? And then, you know, and then a few verses that it's, what do you call it? If we look at the origin of meat, you know, you can say, oh, but it's the body of a living entity. And one living entity lives at the expense of another living entity. Jivo, jiva, si, jivanam. So even if it's a potato or a cauliflower, it's still, you're killing that living entity to eat it. And so then, but the point is, it points out is that the origin of flesh is not as nice as the origin of a vegetable. A vegetable was a nice little clean little seed that you can keep it in your pocket or keep it on a bottle on your shelf and stuff like that, and it's cool. Right? But meat, all meat comes from the semen and ovum. Not a good background, right? So it's impure from the start. So that's why you don't want to get involved in it, right? Then it says that you have the by performing the ashrameda, doing 100 ashrameda yagyas, the benefit you'll get from that, you'll get the same benefit by being vegetarian and offering everything to the Lord. Instead of offering 100 animals to the Lord, you offer all whatever you eat to the Lord for the same 100 years. You get the same benefit. Right? So those few ones come at the end after, you know, so much explanation of the other. So now, others, that because they have material desire, they'll simply see, I can do sacrifices and you know, offer animals. And they'll take that part of it. They won't notice the end. Does that make sense? So all these other, these Vedic literatures, except Bhagavatam, they're generally all written in this form. Is that you're making the point and then getting so much into the mechanics that in the process of explanation you forget or may forget what's actually going on. You get distracted by the secondary explanations. So the logics that are being used, this, that, you'll forget about that it's talking about the Supreme Lord. Like Ayurveda will talk about the connection that everything comes from the Lord. Manu already said everything came from the Lord. But it won't bring that point up again until the very last part of the Vedanta Sutra. I mean, the last part of Manu or like that. So therefore you basically have 11 and a half chapters of technical explanation of which you could easily forget. Does that make sense? So that's the uniqueness of Bhagavatam, is that it always is reminding you all the way through. Everything's always connected back to Bhagavan. So that makes it more clear, and as you said, it makes it more sweet. So in that way, there will be a flavor difference in studying Vedanta Sutra and studying the Bhagavatam. Even if you're having Bhagavatam's quoting Vedanta Sutra, Vedanta Sutra will quote from Bhagavatam, still there'll be that flavor difference.
Maharaj, when it mentions about Jiva is the holder of the Swabhava, what exactly is the meaning of it?
The Jiva is the holder of the Swabhava, means the particular connection with demigods and which karma and all that is going to be according to that particular living entity. He's not in control of the demigods, but it means you have the adiatmic, adidaivic, and adibhotic processes there. So we're saying that whoever's in the adiatmic, then the adidaivic and adibhotic are connected to that particular adiatmic. But that demigod is connected with all the adiatmics that are here. In other words, if you're in charge, like Vayu is in charge of life heirs, he's in charge of every living entity's life heirs. So he's independent of those living entities. But you can say is that the living entity, the individual, is the swabhaviki of the demigod and the karma in this case, because it's connected to him. You know what I'm saying? It's just like the particular businessman, you know, he had an individual businessman, but he has a specific IRS officer assigned to him. He's not in control of the IRS or the officer, but it's that when he sends in his tax form, then that officer looks at it and then approves it or not. So they're working on it. That's where the mistake comes. We see, like in Karma Mimamsa, that, you know, specifically that all these demigods and God and everyone is simply giving you the results of what you do. Therefore, then God can't act without us. They're forgetting that he's independent, and so he can't. He is doing other stuff, and because it's his creation, he's taking part in what he created, and you're taking part in what he created. But by illusion, by false ego, we think we're the controller of our, you know, what's going on. We're the master of our destiny. We're the, you know, all these kinds of things. You know? Yeah.
Vikara means the 11 senses. Mahabhutani are the 5 gross elements. The combination of the 11 senses and 5 gross elements is called the body.
Right? So that's the external part. Action generated from the body, bija, produces another body, roha. This continuous flow, pravaha, is your maya. Right? So this constant, what's going on, means out of the 24 elements, then these ones, then these, what was it, 11, 16? These 16 are the gross body, right? So the other 8, then that's connected with the subtle body. Managed by the subtle body, controlled by the subtle body. So then this is how it goes on. So this combination here, that's the beads for the whole thing, and the whole thing just keeps going on. Though the jiva is different from maya, because being controlled by maya, it is enumerated with maya. That's why then we say atma, then we say is that conditioned nature, that particular false ego. Does that make sense? Because it says good as. It's not, but it's acting like that. I offer respects to the opposite of that maya. Your senses and body, however, are part of you and are not maya. It means for us, everything's separate. But for Krishna, it's not. They're not separate. The Shivadvara continued. With various intentions, you perform pastimes to maintain the demigods, the saintly persons, and the codes of religion for this world. By these pastimes, you also kill those who stray from the right path and live by violence. Because you stray from the path, that's a problem. But then you commit violence in this straying from the path, that's a problem. Because a living entity is just doing whatever they're doing, and another living entity decides to come up and bother them. That's a problem, because there's no need of that. So those who are not following and are violent, then this has to be corrected. So then the Lord, by his coming in whatever form, according to the Yoga Avatar, then he destroys these. So in the Kali Yuga, by coming as a form is the name, the Sankirtan movement, in this way, then the Lord removes this demoniac nature. Does that make sense? And since everybody has it, therefore, you have to have a process by which everybody can be reformed. In other ages, only a few people had it. You could remove them, everything else would go nice. In this age, you remove everybody, there's nothing there. Right? And so then, that's there. So this, So that's not progressive for the human beings, because human beings are supposed to advance. If they're doing nonsense, then it should advance and move forward. Right? So in other ages, maybe you could remove those elements, but who are they removed by? By the Lord himself, or by those individuals, by following the religious processes properly, they're removed, so they get purified. Right? But in the modern sense, then the anarchists, they want to destroy all humankind. Then where's the purification? Where's the upliftment? You just end up with nothing, right? So it's a useless method. So here it's not according to Shastra, and it's violent, so that has to be removed. So those who want to remove have to be removed. With various intentions, you perform pastimes. Oh no, we just did that. Indeed, your present incarnation is meant to relieve the earth's burden. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur comments. Krishna asks, if that is so, then why is there seen in me the material qualities of attachment and hatred revealed by my showing favor or punishment? Right? Krishna likes to play with that. Well, then why is it's the same thing? Shivajwara replies, you desire. Let me protect the devotees who are favorable to me and kill the demons who are inimical to me. By accepting such intentions out of affection for your devotees, for your pastimes, you protect the devas such as Indra, the devotees and munis, who act as the shelter for the people of the world, loka setun, and you destroy those who wander from the path. Thus raga, thus, raga and dvesha, attachment and repulsion, being aspects of your affection for your devotee, are not maya. Thus, I have understood that your birth is for relieving the burden of the earth, your own devotee. Right? So, Bhumi Devi is a devotee, then all the other devotees that are there. So, that's then what has to be done. So, we see here with Banasura, then Banasura, doesn't technically need to be killed. long as he understands his position and acts properly and continues on in his nice way as a servant of Lord Shiva, right? Then Lord Shiva, being his shelter, he's come to protect him because that was his, yes, his promise is there. So then Shiva showing up with his hordes, there's no need to disturb Shiva or the hordes. You just have to scare him off from the battle. Shiva you put to sleep, and the others you scare away. But Banasura's army, by which then he is very proud and all that, and from that then he torments, you know, the earth and other residents on the earth, that has to be removed. So we see that they were actually destroyed. Yes, Kaliya, he didn't have to, he just had to be reformed. So that's the main thing. If you can reform, then that's done. And if you can't reform, so that's why the Kali Yuga is so special, because the process is simply reformation, how to reform everybody in their proper God consciousness. Then no matter what the background, they can move forward from there. Right? Does that make sense? Because it's a spiritual reformation, because the material, you're not going to reform that. It's too far gone. Does that make sense? You know, so you do something. It's like you have old bread that's gone all, you know, how you say, hard and turned green. You can't do anything with it. You can't, you know, as far as the past goes, it's finished. But you can move it forward into penicillin, right? Does that make sense? Yeah. So you move forward. Now, if you say, oh, but he was like this and all that, how can he be devoted? Then that means you need reformation. Because you're not understanding the process. Because if we think, no, it's about the mundane and this and that, we have to reform by the mundane, then the problem is let's first start with the mundane, is for every hot hair on a cow's body, then one must take birth and be killed. Right? On our head, there's about 1 lakh of hairs. Our scalp's not very big compared to a cow. Right? And we're not talking skinny cows here. We're talking nice, big, fat, plump cows. Right? So we're talking about millions and millions and millions of births here. And that's one cow. How many cows in a hamburger? It's all mixed up. You don't know. So, if we want to start with mundane reformation, let's start from this point. Does that make sense? So, that's where we start. Not what the guy just did now, or what he did 20 years as a temple president, he did this and all. We can't start there. Point is the holy name's there, the process is there. Now, if they're acting exactly the same now, then you can say, okay, this is a problem. But if that was 20 years ago that you have to give the example and not now, then you can't use that. Because the process is, even the most severe of offenses, then there's a, what do you call it? It means after 12 years, then you can't blame them. What do you call that in the legal? Yeah, you know, it says...
Double jeopardy.
No, that's another. That's where you can't use double jeopardy, but it just means you can't bring up a case. It's time's over. There's a limit. The statute of limitations, is that it? Yeah. Okay. So even on the most severe, it's 12 years. After 12 years, if you don't see those symptoms there because they've been following the proper process, you cannot refer to that. So make sure you've done your homework that it's within 12 years that as a temple president they did that, not 20 years ago, because that's how you say, 8 years over the statute of limitations. Right?
This one we have 10 years.
10 years, well that's nice.
Discount.
Yeah, good.
That's
good. Yeah. Yeah, so then that's good. So that's the whole thing, is one can't do that. Because if we're going to talk mundane, then mundane is, you know, then study Manusamhita, because then we can deal with the mundane. You know all the laws. But otherwise, devotional service is about association, how to be in a situation where the one doesn't make the non-devotional mistakes. And by that, then one moves forward. So, for Krishna, we can see is that if it's connected to Krishna, then that's considered pious. If it's not connected, it's impious. And not connected means we mean by consciousness. Right? We can't go by the previous verse. No, but everything's connected. Yeah, we don't use that.
Doesn't it mean also that it can be done earlier than 12 years?
Yes, of course. But what I'm saying is, even you want to take the maximum, that 12 years is the maximum of time allotted in Manu for reformation of a severe crime. A severe crime means like killing a Brahmin. That's your 12-year one. Other things are a bit shorter. Okay. Thus, I have understood that your birth, is for relieving the burden of the earth, your own devotee. So he's doing things for the devotee, because the demon deals with Krishna as an enemy. Krishna reciprocates as an enemy, so it's equal. For the devotee, he deals with Krishna as the shelter and support. He reciprocates in that way. So therefore, externally, it looks like he's supporting the devotee and not the demon, but he's actually equal. He's dealing with both, each of them, according to how they surrender. But of all that equalness, he prefers the devotee equalness than the non-devotee equalness. Right? Because there's more taste. Mechanically, it's the same, but in taste, there's more in the one. Yes.
Is that the difference between Krishna karma and the ordinary karma?
Yes. Because Krishna karma means that it's according to what will bring you closer to Krishna.
Right.
But because we have a conditioning that responds in a particular way, our Krishna karma may look very similar to our material karma. Because otherwise, if it's in something else, then, we don't care. Does that make sense? It's just like, let us say there's a pothole in the street. It annoys us, but it doesn't really give us any pain, especially if you drive on another street. But let's say you're, the mayor. It will give you pain. Right? So, creating the manifestation of the temporariness of the material world by a pothole is not going to bother you. But your favorite jeans wearing out or your favorite shoes wearing out, no, that will. So therefore, it comes in the form of what your karma is, though its regulation is controlled by karma, by Krishna. I mean, in material karma, it's also controlled by Krishna, but it's exactly balanced. You've done something, let's say you've done 5 degrees of this, you'll get 5 degrees of reaction. You've done 10, you'll get 10. But in Krishna karma, then it will come in the same field, but you've done 5, but the reaction may only be 1. Right? It won't be more, because it doesn't need to be. Right? So does that make sense? Or it may be nothing, because if one has moved on and doesn't have attachments there anymore, there's no need. And so if there is a reaction, it's just for the benefit of others. For yourself, like Yudhishthir losing the gambling match and ending up in the forest, there's nothing for him to personally gain there. He's always dependent on Krishna anyway. Does that make sense? But for us, there's a lot to learn. Because if we had that situation, then what we would do out in the forest may not be as nice and exemplary as Arjuna. As Yudhishthir. So that's why these things will happen to Yudhishthir and not to us. Something like that. Srila Sanatana Goswami remarks, though you previously gave mercy as Narayana and various avatars, now you've appeared to manifest your unlimited qualities as Bhagavan to benefit the world. Right? So here we can see is that him coming as Narayana and other avatars, much of the time he's just taking the mood of Paramatma. It's not as much as Bhagavan. That's why you see is that the avatars, Leela avatars, then have their own category, even though they may be doing same things as other avatars. The Leela avatar specifically because they're performing things as Bhagavan. But even in that, it may have the element of Aishwarya and therefore have more of a Paramatma flavor. Does that make sense? So when we see it's more the Bhagavan aspect of him as a person and doing not as God, so human life takes on that flavor. But as Narayan, he's God. So the position of God, Paramatma, and that then is basically a similar platform. You have appeared to manifest your unlimited qualities of Bhagavan to benefit the world. You support the devatas by pastimes and kill the deviants from the correct path, who cause violence to others. Or Unmargan refers to demons and wicked kings who violate the scriptural path and live by violence or off others' lives, like Rakshasas. You have appeared from Devaki, Janma, to relieve the burden of the earth by giving mukti and bhakti as suitable to the person. So depending on who they are, they either get directly bhakti or they get liberation, and then from there, then they may move forward. Right? Like Shishupal, he moves into liberation, and then from there, then moves to bhakti. Or now more than previously, you are distributing mercy. You support the devatas by pastimes such as infant activities, nana bhavahi, accepted for playing, not like humans who are forced to accept bodies by karma. You perform, so he does it for fun, right? And to support the demigods. You perform your childhood actions to give the highest bliss to the devatas and others, not as the Lord complete in himself, right? Because the Lord complete in himself, why does he need to go steal butter? You know, if he is butter, then he's already satisfied in himself. So does that make sense? So he does human pastimes, so it appears it's incomplete. But it's his completeness in which he performs these activities, because it's his desire is always fulfilled. So whatever he has, it always works out in a complete way. You nourish those of proper conduct, sadhun, and devotees, loka setun. You create fear in the demons when they hear about you. They also begin to meditate upon you, because they're fearful of Krishna, and so then they start to meditate on Krishna, and in that way then they get benefited, they get purified.
But that means that Kamsa, when he was so much absorbed, he was getting benefit?
Means that you get liberated, yes, they get the exact same benefit.
Oh, liberated.
Yeah, they get liberated.
Temporarily.
They get liberated, and then from there, and in that liberated state, then they remember Krishna. Now they're on the pure state. Then they move forward to Vaikuntha. Or you take those falling paths contrary to bhakti, and by hearing, etc., have them give up the wrong paths and take to the correct path. Right? So that's the whole point. Someone gets deviated, then it's by hearing the correct path, that's then how. So it's by association. That's the only way you correct it. You take birth to decorate the earth. Since I am most sinful, save me, who have surrendered to you by your mercy at this time, though I should be killed. Right? So by Krishna's mercy, he's been able to surrender, and by Krishna's mercy, he may be saved. Though he came out to fight and all that, and he's been defeated, he should have died in the battle. But now that he's surrendering to Krishna, then this will be his position, how he gets saved.
If somebody was a devotee and then they got into bad association and they, like, you know, deviated from devotional service, and then they don't have another chance to get back to devotional service.
No, you always have.
No, I mean, if there are no devotees.
It's just a matter of whether they're interested or not. Because it has nothing to do with the external.
No, I mean, like, but if the process is not available...
But it's always available. You can always chant. You can always remember...
No, but I mean in another... Just say they come again in another lifetime and it's not on the planet. Like the
no, but where would they... They would always be placed in a position they can do that, because they're not a karma.
Okay, yeah, yeah, yeah.
They, from that position, they would go to the heavenly planets.
Okay.
After spending time in the heavenly planets, then they would come down and be born into families, religious families or aristocratic families, so that they have, you know, there's more of a value in you know, philosophy and religion and things like that. They have more facility, they have more time, like that. And so that will always be in a situation which they could take it up. Now, whether they will, that's another thing. It just depends upon them.
Yeah, even if that's on another planet or... Like
doesn't matter. Because if you're from, because as we said, you're here, you go to the heaven planets to come back here. Everybody comes back here. You know, it's like a, you know, Grand Central Terminal. Everybody comes back. Right? Yeah, I'll be back. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Shiva Jwar concluded. I am tortured by the fierce power of your terrible fever weapon, which is cold yet burning, right? So here, Shiva Jwara is cold, but it's a cold fever, right? There's different kinds of fever, and so the cold fever then is as Prabhupada pointed out, it's the one that actually gets you. It's not the hot fever. It's the cold fever, because someone is before they get very very hot, you know, a very high fever, you know, 107 degrees, like that. Then they go to super cold. But it's still a fever. We'll just take it they go cold, but actually it's still a fever. So this Shiva Jwara fever, Narayan Jwara fever, right? I'm tortured by the fierce power of your terrible fever weapon, which is cold yet burning. All embodied souls must suffer as long as they remain bound to material ambitions, and thus averse to serving your feet. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, I cannot praise you any longer because of the weapon sent by you is both cold and burning. Some may argue, it is fitting that you suffer since you cause suffering to others. He answers, those who do not surrender to your feet deserve to suffer, but I have become your devotee. Right? So having become a devotee, now it's going to be different. The Supreme Lord said, O three-headed one, I am pleased with you. May your fear of my fever weapon be dispelled, and may whoever remembers our conversation here have no reason to fear you. Right? So in other words, the high fever, so no one should have any reason to feel that if they remember this conversation. Footnote 32. He who remembers the conversation between you and me will not have fear of you. Krishna says this rather than ordering Jwara, do not give him fever at all. Thus, the statement means, even if fever comes to one who hears this conversation, that person will have no fear. It will be insignificant. Srila Sukadeva Goswami continued, thus addressed, the Maheshvara Jwara bowed down to the infallible Lord and went away. But Banasura then appeared, riding forth on his chariot to fight Lord Krishna. I guess he waited until the various jwaras were finished because he didn't want to get caught up in that. Okay. Srila Sanatana Goswami comments, the Lord did not waver from his good qualities, such as forgiving everyone's faults, achutam. But it's infallible, means whatever he does is perfect. Right, but others then they make imperfection, but he's still perfect in that his dealing with them, he's able to forgive everyone's faults. So that's a chuta. That's why it's very important, because he's on that platform. So then for us to be able to deal with the Lord, we should also strive for that same platform to be forgiven. Otherwise, if we're not done, how is it going to work? Right? Does that make sense? But in forgiving, it doesn't mean that you're unintelligent. You do use your intelligence to not put yourself in the same situations that can cause that problem. Does that make sense? So, it means you're forgiving, but it doesn't mean one's unintelligent. So, you remember. Does that make sense? But it doesn't affect you, right? Does that make sense? Yes? No. Okay, even by recitation of praises or by momentary humility and bestowing fearlessness, if a great offender simply surrenders with words out of fear, right? So simply as momentarily, if they surrender, they'll still get the benefit. Because the point is the soul is supposed to be surrendered to the Lord. So when he does what he's supposed to do, that then remains on the eternal platform, because that's the position of the jiva, they're eternal, and the Lord. So it remains in that position. Does that make sense? It's not that, oh, until he does it all the time. No, it always has an effect. Sakrideva prapanno yas tavasmiti cha ya chate abhayam saravad tasmai dadam yatad vram mama. I give fearlessness to he who surrenders to me once, saying, I am yours. That is my promise. From Ramayana. So that's just the way Krishna works. You surrender, then, even if it's once, he gives that protection. One may argue, is such mercy suitable to give a person who torments the world, right? Because this will be the counter. like that. Like, you know, it was brought up yesterday, I said about forgiveness. We must forgive as devotees. And then they bring up the thing, no, but what if they, you know, they killed my son and this and that? How can I ever forgive them? And, you know, they have to use the most extreme example, you know. What about, you know, they took the last samosa or something? No, they have to, I killed my son, you know. And we're talking about Latinos here, so that's really big, right? You know. So then, you know, this whole problem comes up is that, the point is we're not the body, the son's not the body and all that. So Chitraketu and all that, we're not dealing, you know, which parent? You're which parent in which life? On an unlimited lifetimes, you're the parent in this life? So when you get back to the philosophy, it's also insignificant. You know, it doesn't mean that we're comfortable with it, but it's not that important. So the point is Krishna, then how much nonsense we've done from unlimited lifetimes, we're expecting Krishna to give that up by surrendering, even if it is for a moment. So if we're expecting it should work like that for us, why shouldn't it work like that for everyone else? You know, unless we can establish as we are the one exclusive, you know, special soul, and all others are pretty ordinary souls. So. Yeah.
A good example of forgiveness is when Draupadi's sons were killed.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's in her natural feminine reaction. She's upset and this and that, and wants to take her bath standing on Ashwatthama's head, right? You know. So, but I'm saying the whole point is you know, only a Kshatriya lady could say that. No one else would say that. And so then, but then when she sees him, then he's the son of their teacher. He's a Brahmin. You know, he's been defeated by Arjuna. You know, so all these different things. So then, yeah, one is forgiven. What? Okay. Lord Krishna replies, he is the devotee of Shiva, Maheshwara, and Shiva is dear to me. Right? So that's also why Banasura, because he was such a good devotee of Lord Shiva, that Shiva actually personally would come and take care of him. So then why, you know, Shiva's dear to him, so therefore you leave him alone. You may not have much of an interaction, but you have it with Shiva. Does that make sense? So if you have a friend who has a friend that you don't necessarily like, you don't bother that person because they're the friend of your friend. That's just the way it works. Otherwise, if they weren't the friend of your friend, then of course you'd bother them, right? But you don't, because they're the friend of your friend. Thus, by the mercy of the Lord, all the faults were destroyed at that moment. The word too indicates that though powerful, Jvara went away. Vana came out of great foolishness, right? If Jvara, you know, was defeated and then he left, why should Vana come? He's only got 1,000 arms. What can he do? Jvara can give fever to the whole universe. He can destroy the whole universe. Vana cannot. That means Jvara is more powerful than Vana. So that's why he says out of great foolishness. Vana used Shiva's chariot and his driver, Nandishwar also. Vana came, fighting with the Lord who afflicts the evil people, Janardana. Thus Vana came in order to cause himself suffering. Right? He came to cause his own self suffering. Thus by the mercy of the Lord, all the faults were destroyed at that moment. Oh no, he did that one. Sukadeva Goswami continued, carrying numerous weapons in his 1,000 hands, O king, the terribly infuriated demon shot many arrows at Lord Krishna, the carrier of the disc weapon. As Bana continued hurling weapons at him, the Supreme Lord began using a sharp, razor-sharp chakra to cut off Bana's arms as if they were tree branches, right? Not even trunks, just branches. The branch he just cut off. You know, the trunk you have to saw it a while. Srila Jiva Goswami comments. Later, when Bana began hurling various weapons at Krishna, as soon as the weapons were released, Krishna cut off his arms since he was endowed with all powers, Bhagavan, using a sharp-edged chakra. He did this quickly and easily. Harivamsa describes this. In the battle with Bana, the chakra thrown by the Lord revolved quickly and constantly like a firebrand moving in a circle. So it means it was, you know, you see it has that hot, it's on fire, right? So it's not the... It moved so fast that its form could not be seen. The chakra cut off Bana's 1,000 arms, one at a time, on the battlefield. Right, it cut off one at a time, but it was so fast you couldn't see it, so it was basically like it was simultaneous. Subhadev Goswami continued, Lord Shiva felt compassion for his devotee, Banasura, whose arms were being cut off, and thus he approached Lord Chakrayudha, Krishna, and spoke to him as follows. So you hear like Chakrayudha, and then it gives the thing. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur comments. Okay. So then, Monday, right? Yeah, so no class tomorrow. Right, Gorkhuri. So Monday.
Om Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nityananda Gaura.